You're listening to the Failing Writers Podcast. Well done, Chris Fieldhouse in Wolverhampton. You're our listener of the week. Yay! To everyone else listening, come on. You need to up your game. You really do.
Ooh.
Oh, wait a minute.
Blimey. Tell you what. Is it me, or is this a massive vibe of, like, excitement?
Well, it really is.
I'm so excited right now, I can barely contain myself.
Yeah. Dave's klaxon really got me there.
Yeah.
By the way, why are we excited?
Because we've got a big announcement coming up, John.
The announcement, John. The big
the
announcement.
The big announcement that's coming announcement. Up later on
oh,
in the
yeah.
episode.
Are we saving that for the end?
I think we should.
What, we're going to do, like, a massive episode-long tease because we're mean? Like, people will just fast-forward through the middle and not bother.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we won't say...
Which is fine. I assume that's what they do anyway, so that's all
right. I think that still counts towards listens, so...
No, who cares?
But yeah, big announcement coming up at the end of the show, so... Stay tuned, everybody. Also coming up today, which is equally exciting, but probably doesn't warrant a klaxon, we've got we've got an interview with Rosie Wilby.
Yeah, you can't klaxon women these days, Dave. It's really...
Oh, no, you can't.
Yeah, it's rude.
That's
really
rude.
Yeah,
fair enough. All right.
Would you klaxon a man? Would you?
Huh? I probably would, actually, yeah.
To be fair, Dave probably would, yeah.
Klaxon anybody.
Oh, you've never been on a night out with Dave Baird. It's just a constant, Dave, stop klaxoning. just all the time.
What? Hey?
He's happy with the service at the bar. All of a sudden, klaxons. He's a nightmare. So, yeah, that's a good reason not to fast forward through the rest of the middle of the show, isn't it, really?
Yes.
Fantastic interview with Rosie.
Very interesting.
That gets... quite serious and deep in places, actually, as well, doesn't it?
Didn't it? Yeah.
Which is very us. I feel that's very us. That's what we kind of try and do, isn't it? Really get
I
to the...
I think so. Yeah. We're quite sort of serious.
Not superficial silliness and stupid jokes. We really get to the deep stuff.
Exactly.
That's what we're all about,
isn't it? It's not all gunge and loud noises, is it? This isn't Saturday morning television.
No, it's not one big Knowles House
this
party.
This is serious journalism.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Mm. Listen to Rosie talking about sex rooms later in the show.
That's a good tease. Which, no doubt, do you get your klaxon out for that, Dave, as well? Or?
I might. I should,
you
really.
Shouldn't you? Do you have a special sex klaxon?
Yeah. There should be one for
that. I might put people off a sex klaxon.
Too much detail. We'll leave that. Too much detail.
Never has an interview
too much
got
detail.
My olfactory glands going quite as much as this
back
one
again.
Does.
Oh, anyway, moving swiftly on.
Yes.
Before that,
we have to, because I don't think we did last week, we have to ask the question, the most important question in the world of writing right now. What have you been writing this week, lads?
Tommy, you go.
Well, we can answer that jointly, can't we, this week, really?
Yeah.
Because John tricked us into being in a... virtual room.
He did, didn't he?
So the other week we talked about doing, John had done a writer's
hour.
Is that what it's called? Isn't it? The writer's hour.
Is it writershour.com? Is that right?
And so you just get zoomed into a virtual room full of people ignoring you and writing.
Yeah, and we all did it together, didn't we?
It seemed like a bit of a silly idea, but we thought we'd try it. So we kind of set ourselves a task because we were going to write some poetry for one of the episodes, wasn't we, as a challenge, and there was a poetry competition that had the deadline of the same day.
Yes,
it was booked in to do the so there's kind of pressure on deadline.
That made it exciting, didn't it?
Yeah, so we thought we'd do an hour in there and see if it worked.
In theory, we were supposed to get the poetry done in an hour, but that didn't really happen.
Did you
what was the competition called again?
Ooh,
was it the writers
for Writers Online?
Writers Online,
and it was for a Triverson poem.
That's the one, a Triverson, yes. What is a Triverson, John?
Well, a Triverson, I'll just quickly Google it. a Triverson is a six-stanza poem, isn't it? And each stanza is three lines.
Yes.
I believe.
So, yes, it's basically just six sentences, isn't it?
Yeah.
But edited to look a bit like poetry.
Yeah.
It was originated by William Carlos Williams.
Old Willie Carlos Williams.
Old WCW. Mm-hmm.
Oh, hey, what was he like?
I don't know. Read some of his poems, and maybe you'll find out what he was like, yeah.
So did you not actually finish yours in the session, John?
Well, I did come up with six stanzas of three lines, but I totally changed it afterwards.
Right, okay.
So in theory, I did write something in that time.
So you did the, you did the base work, the foundations of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I didn't change that much, to be
How
fair.
Did you find the experience, though? Because, John, you've done it before, but Tom, how did you find the whole writer's hour experience?
I still maintain it is a little bit weird. That's not to say I didn't enjoy it, but I got a little bit distracted at times, just kind of flitting around. Because it was like about, what, 150 people in there, maybe?
I don't know, maybe more.
It's quite a lot, weren't there?
And I just like being nosy and just kind of looking at people and seeing what room they're in and stuff and things.
We didn't really crack on for a while, did we? It was a lot of texting each other with our stupid suppositions about the lives of the other people in the Zoom call.
Yeah.
What they were really up to.
Which is, you know, very immature and unproductive. But in places it was quite funny.
I was fortunate. All of that went into my junk folder, so I didn't see it until the end. Right. So I actually was the good boy in class who concentrated.
Presumably you wrote a couple of poems, Bertie, in that time.
No, I wrote about 3.5.
3.5 poems, Dave. That's
really
brilliant.
Well done, mate.
No. 3.5 lines.
Right, that's half a poem.
I felt really self-conscious. There's like all these people looking at you, even though they're not looking at you any more than you're looking at them, although I did spend a bit of time looking at them.
Yeah. I
don't know. I did feel self-conscious. But having said that, I did do nothing other than write for a whole hour. I was totally focused on writing. I didn't look at my phone. I didn't go make a cup of tea. I didn't walk around playing darts. I did so for what it was supposed to be. It absolutely worked.
Yeah.
And it was free. So totally worth it. But yeah, I think weird, but ultimately does what it says on the label.
You feel self-conscious enough to actually crack on and do some work. I think that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite good.
Yeah, every time I thought about doing something else, it was like, no, someone's going to see.
Point at you and write in the chat box, what's Dave Baird doing?
Yeah. But I did do a few things, like I found myself over-exaggerating some mannerisms. So when I'd be writing something and then I go, oh, that's not right. But I felt like because people were watching, I felt like I had to make a big deal of, oh,
that really
silly
rub
me.
Your chin.
Oh, got that right.
Yeah.
Totally misunderstood that. Oh, start again. So, yeah, I don't know if that was good or bad, but I wrote half of what I was supposed to write in an hour.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
How did you find the actual, I mean, clearly it didn't just flow out of you, but how did you find the actual writing of poetry?
Well, I disappeared up my own arse for a while. Mm. I found.
I think that's what you do with poetry a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe the good thing about it.
So my plan was, I kind of had a thought of what I was going to write about, and then I just wrote down six just little bullet points of like the argument of what I was going to say, and then thought, right, then I'll just turn each of those six little lines into a verse for the poem. But I got a bit carried away with thinking, oh, because it's a poem, I need to sort of flower it up and, you know, look for. I was had the thesaurus open, looking at different ways of saying things, and I just went so far the other way that it didn't make any sense at all. It was just flowery bullshit.
Yeah, I think with poetry, you've just got to rely on yourself. I think
you're right. I think
it's like doing an exam almost, where you can do all your revision and stuff outside of it, but once you're doing it, you've just got to rely on what's inside you and what you've got naturally at your disposal. Yeah.
In an earlier episode, Tommy, you were talking about how your subconscious is a very important part of creativity and how all the brain systems of that are making the connections between things. And that is sort of how it feels. It feels like you have to let your subconscious go with it a bit.
And I think it helps with that is because when we had Kate Fox on, she was her sort of one of her hints and tips for poetry was to write about something that you genuinely have a connection with or a passion for, or feel something about. And I tried to do that, but what I realised quite quickly is that
no one wants poems about Bob and biscuits.
No, what I realised was I don't really care about anything. I'm not really passionate about anything, really.
Would you say you're quite passionate about feeling like that, though, Dave?
Quite passionate about
being... You sound like you've got some like real something inside you about not being passionate about anything.
Yeah, I'm passionate about being soulless.
You should do like a banner and stand outside a town hall somewhere. What do I want? Nothing in particular. When do I want it?
Well, I don't know. Before closing time. So yeah, it was quite difficult in that sense. And the other hint and tip that I struggled with of Kate's was, and I think it was quite a good tip, she said you don't have to make your last line a sort of pithy, it doesn't have to be like a punchline, it doesn't have to sort of da-da-da-da-da, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I really struggle with that. I felt like I've got to finish on some sort of,
you have to end on a high.
I think a lot of it with poetry though is it's like a gentle punchline at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like you're putting it gently down.
Yeah.
Rather than kind of sending it up in the air for everyone to see.
Yeah. And it is definitely with poetry is not completing the circle thing as well that we were talking about before.
Well, it depends on who's judging your work, doesn't it, sometimes?
Very true.
Some people like everything to be completely finished and compacted into an easy, soluble, swallowable, idiot-proof.
Yes, but moving on.
Well, you know,
moving swiftly.
They're not always right, are they?
Not always right. But no, I do. I very much feel like I've got to finish everything with a full stop. You know, it's got to be quite clear that that's the end. It doesn't necessarily have to, like say, complete the circle, but it's got to be clear. Here's the end of the argument, or here's the last expression.
Was it Kate who said the thing about delete the first stanza or the first line or the last line as well?
I think she did, yeah.
Like get rid of the top and the bottom.
I think she said that, which again was a problem because the first line was very much my favourite bit.
You could have just moved your first line down a bit.
Yeah. I've basically ignored all of the tips from the actual working poet when it came to writing my poetry.
Do you think maybe, because poetry is sort of freer than prose, you don't have that sort of self-censorship override switch on? Do you know what I mean? So when I'm writing prose, I'm always kind of critiquing my own writing. Whereas I think with poetry, you just, I don't know, it's like you just vomit it out and see what comes out. It's sort of
I don't know. I felt I'm the exact opposite.
Right. Interesting.
Because writing prose, I feel there are no sort of restrictions on the sort of rhythm or the length of a sentence or what have you. You can just write whatever you want in prose. Whereas because there is a kind of imposed format, particularly in this, where we're writing, a very sort of strictly formatted version of a poem, the Trivison.
Yeah, but the lines could be any length and it didn't have to rhyme or anything. Do you know what I mean?
That's true, I still felt like I was, it was much more sort of conscious of like, no, think of a line, no, that's not quite right. Think of something else, no, that's not quite right. Rather than just writing something down.
Yeah.
We're exact opposites,
yeah,
John.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, I wrote three poems in the...
Oh, bloody hell, here we go.
Were they all brilliant?
Two of them were. One of them was just average. But
I can't wait to hear them, Tommy.
Mr. Productive.
Well,
I
can't do them now because I've entered two of them into the competition.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to have to
wait. So are you going to win first and second place in this competition?
First and third, maybe. I don't know. No, but I felt happy. I just felt happy with them. And they kind of came out nicely. It was weird. They kind of just fell into the format. And they didn't need... They were six sentences long. Do you mean like the kind of...
Yeah.
Just sort of happened.
Yeah. I think it partly was the environment of actually just sitting down and, like Dave said, not going, right, I'm going to sit down and do some, let's go put the kettle on.
Yeah.
And then, oh, no, we're here.
It's amazing. It is amazing how productive you can be, isn't it, when you just force yourself to sit.
I think sort of to come back round and complete this particular circle, that is definitely something that Writer's Hour would be really good for. I wouldn't do it again and if I was just thinking, oh, I might write something. But if I had a very specific kind of, right, I want to finish this chapter, or I want to, if a very specific goal of something that I could do in an hour, I would definitely do that again, sort of force me to just get on with it.
Yeah.
And they are just unerringly positive.
They really are.
To the point where you're not sure whether it's real or not, but it's so nice. You don't really care. Everything's just so chilled and happy and like nice and
is. They've got the vibe right, haven't they? Definitely
lovely.
Yeah. I think we're probably converted from our cynicism. Really, it's a nice thing to do.
Mm.
It's ridiculous. It's silly, but it's a nice thing.
But
to
it does
do.
Seem to work. Yeah, that's the main thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Marks out of 10.
Oh God!
Let's not even go there, Dave.
So are you asking us for marks out of 10?
Yeah, I'm not going to do
it. Was that like
it.
A questioning of how marks out of 10 works?
I'd have to come up with a complicated category system, so let's not.
I give it a solid 8.
Solid 8, yeah. John?
Yeah, no, I'd go 8. I can concur with that, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was really good, so I'd give it a 6.
No, it works at all, Dave. Well done.
We should probably move on now, shouldn't we, to the things that we promised earlier in the episode.
Yes. So let's introduce our guest for today. It's Rosie Wilby. Tell us a little bit about Rosie Wilby. How did Rosie Wilby get in touch, by the way, Birdie? She got in touch with you, didn't she?
Yes. So she saw us mentioned in an email newsletter from Great British Podcasts, where we have occasionally featured.
She saw us mentioned.
She saw us on there, got in touch, said she wanted to talk to us because we just sounded great.
And we, in return, checked her out, and she looked excellent. She's a stand-up comedian.
Yep.
She's also a writer. She's written several books, mainly about relationships.
Yes.
Non-fiction books. But she's done lots of other things as well. She was a journalist. She has been a musician.
In the Hit Parade. And her current book, The Breakup Monologues, is doing really well at the minute. She's also got a podcast called The Breakup Monologues. So you should listen to that after this. Not right now. When this is finished, go and listen to the Breakup Monologues.
Yeah, hang on a minute.
But yeah, should we hear her talk about such things now?
Let's do it.
Let's say a big welcome to Rosie. Rosie Wilby, thank you very much for joining us today.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's lovely to be with you.
Thank you for being foolish enough to come on something called the Failing Writers Podcast.
Yes, I liked the sound of the title, Failing Writers. I mean,
did it appeal to you on some level? Is there a bit of you inside that is forever a failing writer despite your success?
I think it's just really interesting how we define failure and success. Is that about money, which would mean that most authors would feel like they're failing?
Yeah.
Or is it about, you know, succeeding creatively and achieving the aims that you wanted to when you set out to write your book?
Yeah, like that kind of cultural exposure.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Or is it some kind of acceptance and popularity and... Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it?
It is. What would you say if someone was failing on all those points? I think then you would have to say there is a level of lack of achievement.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're not even pleasing yourself...
Wow, she's gone straight for the dagger through the heart early doors there, hasn't she?
Yeah. No, but I just think sometimes, I mean, my podcast, which is all about breakups, is all about how we can learn from failure. And how often, you know, being at your low point when you really feel like you've not done the things you set out to in your relationship or in your career or in your life, those are the times when you actually figure it out and you start problem solving and you start thinking really creatively and you change tack. I mean, I changed from being a musician to being a comedian because... You know, to some extent, I felt my music career was, in inverted commas, failing. Although, you know, when I look back now, I achieved a lot of things. I played at some fantastic festivals. Right. I had an album out. It was on my own label, so it was sort of grassrootsy and DIY. But it was in all the major shops and, you know, it got played on the radio and it got nice reviews and all of these things. But I think... Often we kind of set ourselves very high standards, don't we? And we judge ourselves very harshly when we don't meet them.
Yeah, because that's very much sounds successful, doesn't it?
I think probably now more than ever, we judge ourselves by the very top, the creme de la creme, don't we? Because that's what we kind of see and are exposed to on everything, on social media and stuff. We kind of judge it by, well, I'm not the Rolling Stones, this is rubbish.
And you think, I want to be like them, but there's so much... involved with being that successful that, yes, to some extent, you know, when you're talking about the Rolling Stones and, you know, Mick Jagger, you know, you are talking about charisma and persona and the sort of dreaded X factor that we talk about and talent. But there's so much that goes into whether somebody achieves that kind of level of huge recognition and, you know, monetary wealth that is... you know, beyond things we have control over. And a lot of it, you know, I'm kind of, you know, as well as writing, I occasionally mentor a couple of writers that I know. And, you know, I'm realising how difficult it is. I mean, one of them said to me, you know, she just kind of realised that, you know, how well your book does in the eyes of the publishing world is nothing to do with how good it is. And it's quite dispiriting and depressing when you first realise that it is about, you know, connections and privilege. It is sometimes about being white and posh and straight.
Yeah.
You know.
What is your criteria for success, ooh, then, Rosie?
It's really complex. I do think that achieving your creative aims and actually saying what you want to say and being able to finding a space to be authentic is a big part of it.
I like that because that's aiming quite low. I can probably just about do that. That doesn't involve the money or the actually anyone listening to the content. Or,
well, I think if you can't be authentic, then what would be the point? You know, if you, I don't know, wrote some trashy romance novel. I mean, not that all romance novels are trashy, don't get me wrong. But if you wrote something deliberately to make money and you didn't, it wasn't what your heart was in.
Yeah.
I don't know if that is really success, is it? I mean, for some people it might be, but I'm not sure it would be for me. I mean, people say to me, oh, why don't you do this or that or whatever? Because sometimes some of the subjects I tackle are quite challenging and difficult. You know, my first book was called Is Monogamy Dead? And I got, you know, I got a very funny protest letter delivered through the bookshop letterbox on the day that I was due to be doing my launch there. It's great. It's a gift. I read it out now. I'm proud that my book made somebody so angry that they'd got up early before a bookshop opened in order to post a letter through the letterbox to instruct me that I was wrong in questioning monogamy and that, you know, marriage...
Long-term
monogamy and marriage were the most effective forms of cohabitation yet discovered. You know?
I'm going to assume that person probably didn't read the book either.
No, he did say he was going to save his pennies and not buy the book, which is kind of interesting because my book, if you do read it, is all about how monogamy could survive and thrive.
I'm not going to read it, Rosie. I'm just going to complain about it later.
Thank you. I love that.
I suppose if you were saying that, surely you would have called it Monogamy Is Dead rather than Is
Indeed,
Monogamy Dead.
Indeed, you are right. I know, that's it. I was asking a question and I was sort of looking at how we live now and how we're quite serially monogamous and how we've altered the meaning of monogamy from one marriage for life to one marriage at a time.
Yeah, monogamous for now.
Monogamous with this person for now.
Monogamy now sounds like quite a good movie.
I don't know.
Sounds like a very bad magazine that you'd accidentally pick up in the dead.
I think it's so interesting, this whole discussion about failure and success. And I think we're constantly redefining those parameters. And I do think causing discussion and debate is something that I find rewarding. You know, I was glad when people told me that they'd read my book Is Monogamy Dead and found it had really made them stay up all hours with their partner discussing it, what it meant
to them.
That's
genuine engagement, isn't it?
I think clever publishers do get it and do see that, but it's sad that the main model that we have for rewarding writers financially is purely based on a number of sales, which is a very crude, way of looking at things.
Yeah.
In the process of discussing topics like that, Rosie, you really open yourself up, don't you? Like, the three of us write fiction, but you've kind of turned your life, particularly like the intimate secrets of your love life, into your art, out there on display for everyone to consume and comment on and judge.
Yeah, it's really tough, actually. But I think it's important to be honest and be authentic, but hopefully not at the cost of anyone's feelings, because I think I'm usually the butt of the jokes. I mean, or at least I hope so. And I try to represent other people fairly and consciously and compassionately.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I have arguments with my partner where we completely remember incidents totally differently that only happened a couple of days ago. So to sort of, you know, to try and write something from a sort of, you know, a reasonable point of view about things that might have happened years ago must be quite tricky.
You are aware in those arguments, Dave, that you are wrong, aren't you?
Absolutely. I have been informed of that on many occasions.
No, I thought,
Tom,
just in case you were. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, just in case. Yeah, especially conversations and dialogue. The first time I wrote a memoir, I mean, and parts of this did go into my first book, but it originally had a different title. It was about my music career. It was called How Not to Make It in Britpop.
Right.
And I entered it into a writing competition where very luckily, I was shortlisted, fortunately. And that was kind of the beginning of me finding an agent and publisher and starting to get published. But yeah, it was interesting. I used to write, you know, big, long chunks without any dialogue because I couldn't remember exactly what people had said and I didn't think you could make it up. But then I spoke to more and more writers of nonfiction and memoir who said, yes, you've got to. You need to have dialogue, but, you know, if you can remember certain phrases or words or even the energy or emotion of the conversation and you try and represent that honestly and emotionally and fairly and you try and represent the other person. You know, as authentically as you can, you know, I think that, you know, well, enough writers said to me that they do that too and they think that's fair enough, that I felt that that would be okay.
I've been reading quite a lot of like couples therapy books as research for a show that I'm writing with my wife about marriage. And it's been really interesting. But yeah, I was going to ask you, is there like a secret to a successful marriage or a relationship? Is there something that you've picked up on your journey that's a real like key thing that you have to bear in mind in a relationship?
Yeah, well, I think perhaps connected to the themes we're talking about, I think not being scared of failure. I think if you're not scared of it breaking up, if you know you could survive that, even though you'd miss the person desperately and you really want to make it work, if you know that it's not this terrible threat, this terrible dark cloud looming on the horizon, oh my God, what if we break up? You can sort of just get on with things. Whereas in relationships I've been in the past, when I think it possibly is going to break up, that is just such a threat and just such a fear. And this fear of failure is so great that it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
As I say, it changes your behaviour, doesn't it? It hangs over you every...
And I think if you have a view that somehow this person is the one and the only one for you and you simply won't be able to live in the world without them, which is sort of what all the romantic films would have us believe. But I think if you really buy into that, you are scared. Yeah, you are too petrified when you're in a partnership.
But to be fair, if you're going to go by romantic films, then what needs to happen before that is you need to be stalked. but it's fine because you're a sort of a pretty attractive film star. So it's okay. Do something really creepy that would land most people in jail. And then you fall in this love.
That's Hollywood rom-coms, yeah.
I remember I did once see this film where a woman's way of seducing somebody was to fire an arrow through her window while she was up a tree outside her flat with a love note wound around the arrow. I thought, what a sophisticated way of... And I mean, it could go badly wrong.
You know? P.S. Sorry for shooting your cat.
That's quite full on.
That is quite full on, indeed.
I think the 80s have a lot to answer for, don't they, in many ways, including the films that they popped out and what... Do you mean even stuff like The Goonies? I remember growing up as a kid, you wanted an adventure, didn't you? Like a really dangerous adventure.
But to be fair,
adventure back
in the 80s, that was quite easy to achieve, wasn't it? Do you know what I mean? There were lots of like open quarries and...
Just to go and play.
That's kind of what we did, isn't it, really?
And children were less out on their
own bridges and things like that. Yeah.
Nobody cared about us when we were kids.
It does sound terribly cliche now, doesn't it, for old people like us to say, well, when I was a kid, we were just go on our bikes and then your mum would be shouting, tea is ready, just make sure you're back before sunset.
Yes, that's right. But also there was kind of a low bar, wasn't there? Because we didn't have so many competing forms of entertainment
and
that many TV channels or internet or all these gadgets. You know, so you would amuse yourself with really rubbish things.
Because if you got kids now and said, right, you can either go on your PS5 for a couple of hours or you can go out into the backfield and hit something with a stick. Oh, yeah. It's not even going to be like, well... What am I hitting and how big's the stick? They're just going to be like, nah, just stay in the room on the PS5, texting me mates. They'd probably say in it.
Little insight into Tommy's childhood there.
You're listening to the Failing Writers Podcast. And I bloody well suggest you carry on doing so.
So tell us more about your podcast. How long has it been going now?
Oh, The Breakup Monologues has been going since, I think it was the end of 2017. And that came after a trilogy of shows I'd done about love and relationships, solo comedy shows. And that had ended with one about breakups because the whole trilogy had been about the psychology of love. And so my solo show was called The Conscious Uncoupling, which was about the email breakup. So it was kind of an ironic title. And then that got other people, other performers and friends and writers all talking to me and sharing their breakup stories with me. So I thought we really should have a chat show where other people shared their stories of relationship failure. And we kind of compared war stories and compared war wounds and talked about how we'd reinvented ourselves and we'd healed.
Yeah, I guess because I think there are similarities with that and with this podcast, because some your relationship with the things that you're writing is kind of like relationships with other people sometimes. Like, you know, sometimes you invest a lot of time and effort into it and you pour your sort of heart and soul into it. And then sometimes you've just got to accept that things aren't really working. And, you know, can you let it go?
Well,
or do you have to keep on plugging away?
Because in my book version of the Breakup Monologues, which kind of has my story underpinning things, there are lots of bits and pieces and little highlights from the podcast scattered throughout. But it essentially tells my story. And I do include friendship breakups and professional breakups in that. And the professional breakup, the lead-in story for that, is my breakup with my first literary agent, which I still would say is one of my most painful ever breakups, because she was also a friend and somebody that I had invested a lot of hopes and dreams in building a relationship with, you know, because she had been to lots of my comedy shows and I thought had a good sense of where, you know, I was coming from as a creative artist. Not to be fair, I think she did, but I think we disagree about the structures of the publishing industry and how, you know, as I've alluded, how the finances are kind of distributed. And, you know, I mean,
all relationships, it comes down to money.
Well,
in the end.
I think particularly work relationships do. I talk about seven reasons for breakups at the start of my book, and sex is usually the number one for romantic relationships breaking down. But I do also note that all of my professional breakups have been to do with disagreements over money.
I think if you reach a time where your professional relationships are breaking down because of the sex, then there's other problems deeper seated, to be honest.
Indeed. But then, we've done it, haven't we? We've been there. But yeah, I do think there was some complicated stuff going on around the publication of my first book, because the publisher were going out of business, and they were sort of not being totally upfront with all their authors about what was happening. So we were not getting royalty statements or royalty payments and not getting the things done that were being said they were going to get done. And also, you know, people were getting made redundant. Everybody was leaving. There was nobody left. You rang up the office. There was no answer. The office moved to some kind of cupboard somewhere. There was no marketing team doing any marketing. There was nobody doing any tweets. There was nothing happening. And something clearly wasn't right. So a lot of writers were in a very anxious position. And, you know, I guess I'm one very much for honesty and authenticity. And I just felt what was happening wasn't right. And I don't know, I guess my agent felt that you've got to always be nice and grovelly to your publisher because they're publishing your book, even if you know that they're doing something a bit shady.
Yeah.
I mean, that publisher has now been bought out by another lovely publisher, and everyone I've dealt with there seem absolutely wonderful and very transparent, and I get proper royalty statements now that make sense. So that's all good. And my new book is with Bloomsbury, who've been really, really great as well. So hopefully, you know, there's a happy ending to the story and all is good. All right. No, it all worked out okay, but I felt really sad and quite distraught at that breakup with my first agent, because I felt she wasn't hearing me and I felt I was actually being authentic to true and values I really believe in, where you do sort of stand up to unethical practices, I guess, and you don't just go, oh, thank you very much for publishing my book, even though you've actually not done any of the things that you said you would do. I mean, you can ask questions politely, but I do think you can ask questions.
I imagine it's quite easy to take advantage of writers because they're just so excited to be published and, you know, to be going along with.
Well, you look at the amount of industry out there that's, you know, pseudo publishers that will land you with a $5,000 bill for nothing in particular. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
I had because my first book has not officially been published in the US. My contract was just for the UK and Commonwealth, excluding Canada. I mean, it's weird because it does seem to be made available in the places it's not supposed to be in anyway, and I didn't grant the rights to. But there we are. That's another thing. You know, I was asking questions about, which I apparently shouldn't have been asking questions about, but there we are. There was this company that did approach me about publishing it in the US, and they were not asking me for money. They were going to pay me a very, very, very tiny amount of money.
Yeah.
But I started looking at authors who had been published by this publisher, and there would be like a tweet saying, "Oh my God, so excited. My book comes out in the US today." And then there was silence. There was just nothing. And I thought, and this was author after author after author.
You think the publisher had been murdering the authors? What? So, wow.
Oh, my God.
Oh, there's a book idea
How
there.
How dark.
No royalties.
Start of
ding,
a
ding.
Novel there, isn't it? Yeah.
I hadn't gone there.
Yeah, I think that's what happened. I can't believe you didn't see that. That is definitely what happened.
Such a good job you didn't go with them. Wow.
You would, I wouldn't be having this conversation now if you'd have signed up.
Oh, my God, I wouldn't be here now. Yeah. Talk about failed writers, murdered writers.
Rosie, do you enjoy the act of writing?
Ooh.
I know that sounds like a stupid question because you have written. So presumably you like it
a little bit.
But do you get quite into it? And
yeah, I do. And I have moments when I do. But, I mean, I do think there's something in the, you know, the famous saying, isn't there, that, you know, to hate writing but love having written.
Yes.
You know, and it's very rewarding to have your book all finished. And, I mean, this new book, I'm very...
Is it rewarding?
I think so. Because my new book is in hardback.
Sorry, just because I...
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't really produced anything, so that's why
I do think there's some reward in that for sure. And for me, really, and this has been slightly depressing in a pandemic, the real reward and the reason why I do anything is to then go and perform a show about it, to go and talk about it on stage in front of audiences, or to come on podcasts like this and have really fun conversations about the work that I've done. I mean, this podcast is more meta, isn't it? We're kind of talking about the process of writing as much as we're talking about, you know, what I've written about. And that's really fun too.
Yeah. Yes.
I think, you know, the sad part is that if you're sort of a minority voice in that, you know, I'm very open about being an LGBT woman and having relationships with women. And even though my book is really universal and it has stories from all kinds of other people, from all points on the sexuality spectrum, gender, age, different, you know, people from all different walks of life. You know, I think ultimately the central story is, you know, some very heteronormative people will see that, oh, is that a gay book because it's written by a lesbian about her relationship with another lesbian. Whereas I say, now this is kind of my latest idea for trying to reach the tricky to reach heteronormative readers who definitely avoided my first book. I think I've caught some of them out with my new book.
they're easily fooled.
I know. But I think actually everybody should be reading books. Well, we should all be reading outside of our comfort zone anyway, because we learn more then. We're more enriched by thinking about different lives. You know, I realised only in the last couple of years or so, with the whole Black Lives Matter movement, how much white culture I consume, because that's what always seems readily available. And, you know, it's been really great to try and consume other stuff and brilliant programmes like I May Destroy You recently. I do think that it's important for everybody to read books by LGBT people, particularly non-fiction books about relationships. Doesn't have to be mine, but there are others too, because gay...
It'd be good if it was yours though, wouldn't it?
That'd be ideal.
Be better if it was yours.
It would. But gay people, I don't know if you know this, have typically, historically, been ahead of the curve with relationship trends because gay people have sat outside of the kind of normative narratives of getting married and having kids. So gay people have coined phrases like living apart together, have experimented with non-monogamy before it became a wider discussion in the mainstream community. Lesbians pioneered conscious uncoupling long before Gwyneth Paltrow. and, you know, Armistead Maupin, obviously fabulous queer writer, talks about the idea of a logical family as opposed to biological family and kind of celebrating community and seeing your friends as your family. And I think now all these ideas are part of the broader heteronormative tapestry. But in a way, LGBT people have been the sort of pioneers and the experimenters with all of these ideas. So, you know, if you do kind of listen to podcasts by queer people and read books by queer people, you might be getting a taste of what everyone's relationships are going to look like in the next 5-10 years.
What needs to come.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think, I mean, for me, that's the kind of the point in reading. You know, I think it's the fun thing or the interesting thing about reading is to kind of drop into different people's shoes, you know, and live different lives and find out what, you know, what else is going on in the world. You know, I don't really want to read about people like me.
I don't think anyone wants to read about people like you, John, to be fair.
Exactly. Exactly my point.
I like the idea. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. A gay book. Just the idea of a gay book.
Well,
I just have the image of an old couple, middle-aged old couple, walking through the airport and Donald's putting his hand out to try and buy this book and his wife telling him off.
Oh, dear.
Donald, put that down.
Donald.
That's a gay book, that. Okay. Not reading that.
Well, gay book. This is so interesting, and it touches on something very close to my heart, and this idea of, you know, almost segregation in the bookshops and on the bookshelves, and how there is a gay section for gay books, because surely only gay people are going to read gay books.
Yeah.
Which is, it's crazy, because as I've just said, I do think we should all be reading books by people outside of our peer group.
People. I think people's a good word in that, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
we're just literally people.
Yeah.
It is weird.
Do you find it must be changing, though? I feel like there must be lots of people who don't think like that. I mean, it must be easier to be,
of course,
to be a stand-up who's lesbian, but it doesn't just do exclusively, you know, same-sex jokes, if that
absolutely,
exists as a
yeah.
thing.
No, indeed. And I try to talk about relationships really broadly and universally. And if I do talk about gay stuff, I try and make it, you know, interesting for a wider audience. Like when I used to talk about coming out, it wasn't really about the act of coming out so much as how weird and icky it is to talk to your parents about anything intimate and personal. Yeah.
Have you noticed your audiences change when you talk to them after a show?
What, have I noticed how enlightened they are suddenly?
No, have you turned them all gay?
by the end of the show.
Rosie, I was going to ask, just you're kind of looking at your sort of outline of your career and everything. And you were saying about kind of the performing side of it is kind of where you like to get to. And that's what kind of does it for you. Has that been the driving force behind everything you've kind of done? Was that you as a kid? Were you the performing one wanting an audience?
Oh, no, not really. I was very, very shy. And I am quite introverted, really. But I think once I found creativity and started writing songs and then stories and expressing myself, then I think you do want to share it with people. You want the reward and affirmation of people going, oh, that's good. And I think doing that on stage live is the most immediate way of seeing and hearing that feedback.
But it's more about sharing your stuff than just being applauded by an audience then.
Oh, gosh, yes. It's not being applauded for just, you know,
doing
if I was
turn.
Going to get up and sing a cover version or, I don't know, reading out someone else's story. I mean,
that'd be a weird thing in comedy, actually, doing cover versions, wouldn't it? You just did someone else's act.
They do exist. They do exist.
They do exist.
I've seen a Peter Kay tribute comedian at a working men's club in Rotherham.
Shut up.
How'd you get away with that?
I mean, we thought about doing it once when I did a three-header show in Edinburgh. We thought about maybe on the last night, like trying to do each other's sets or something.
Wow,
But no, I mean, if it was material that still meant something to me, I guess it would still have a resonance. But it's very much about sharing my story and having my story be heard. Because I think if I don't tell my story, then who will?
Yeah.
And I mean my story in a whole number of ways. I guess my story as a gay person who came out in the right at the end of the 1980s, when it was very, very hostile as a teenager then, when the world was deeply homophobic.
What was that like then?
You know, tough. I mean, my parents were, you know, the two people who were quite okay with it, really, because my mum was very progressive, and I've done comedy about how she told me, she started to tell me all about her and her friend Joan, who were awfully close. And I was like, oh, no. And she embraced it.
I don't want to know, Mum.
I know, exactly. And she just started telling all the neighbours, and she was overexcited about it. Cringy, but bless her. Lovely, really. So, you know, coming out and also, you know, facing all the challenges of being an introverted only child who still had something to say and wanted to find a way to say that. And, you know, having been bullied and excluded at school and not feeling, you know, part of any of the cool cliques, you know, all that stuff, it does scar you, you know, and it's hard to recover from, and you have to find your way. And you, I think there's an urgency to feeling heard when you've been really erased and ignored in those formative years as a child and a teenager. Mm.
Sorry, that's gone a bit deep for our podcast. No, I'm going to go, oh, it really has.
Sorry about that.
Hey, should we lighten things up? I've got a light question for you. Where are you doing any live gigs? We've got stuff coming up imminently, or is COVID still...
I am going to be gigging.
What have you got coming up?
I'm doing... a festival called Shout Festival in Birmingham. In November, there's a lovely comic called Maureen Younger who always organises Comedy Night as part of that. There's lots of things coming up that I can't even remember. Lots of different comedy nights, literary nights. I've just been asked to host a kind of quite academic and fancy sounding literary night as well.
Sounds like the place that we should be, eh?
I know. I always feel quite good when I get to do those gigs where it's in a bit of a fancy place, like a museum or an arty kind of, you know, the ICA or I don't know, somewhere that's a bit, you know, a bit cerebral, because I feel like I've gone up in the world here, you know.
Yeah.
Proper classic.
Good quality, quality wood panelling or something.
Yeah, that's right. So there's definitely a few things coming up.
Did the not performing thing hit you quite hard? I mean, obviously people have had tougher times in the pandemic, but in terms of, obviously you were saying that's a huge part of what you do. Did you find other ways to... expose yourself to the world, or were you just
expose myself
ticking along and waiting?
What gigs do you think I'm doing? Although interestingly, I did once do a comedy gig at a sex party.
Was it a sex party before you started doing your gig, or
yeah, people just got bored and just started shagging? No,
how bad would your act have to be?
I've heard this one, let's just get on with it. I mean, if you can hear sweet rappers going, that's bad enough, isn't it? But
did they warn you before you started?
Don't you worry, it was a sex party and I was aware of it, but the sex room had not been opened yet.
Oh, God,
I could almost smell that when you said the sex room. It has a smell to it, doesn't it, the phrase? I'm not sure there's any other phrases that have such a definitive smell.
Yeah, but it was quite an experience. It was really fun. Like, the cabaret is quite short because people are impatient to get on with it. It's a rewarding gig. People are really in a good mood.
Yeah, just play the chorus. Just play the chorus and then...
Oh, just do your last joke.
Knock, knock. Okay. Who's there? Someone at the sex room. Let's get on.
Now, obviously, this sex party did not happen during the pandemic.
No.
Just need to point that out for legal reasons.
So, like you say, the pandemic did close down the comedy circuit for a good old while. And I'm really glad that it's been back, because I have been doing a number of festivals just this past few weeks. Just about to release an episode of the podcast recorded at Green Man Festival in Wales, which was really
Have you noticed a difference in the audiences coming back? Are people just really hungry for it? Because I think there's a people are desperate to get back out.
Yeah, I think so. I think people are really into it and people are really engaged.
And maybe so, kind of almost grateful for it.
Yeah. I think it definitely felt like that at the festivals that I've done recently, Green Man and Prima Donna Festival, and we did a show at Underbelly Festival as well. So, yeah, that's definitely felt. And I was at Wilderness as well. It's a lovely festival. And definitely at those, I think there was a feeling of that, because all of those, of course, had been cancelled the previous year.
Rosie, what's next? Have you got another book lined up? Are you writing anything at the moment?
Not officially, no. I've got a few ideas. I've got a new podcast idea. I'm working on just a little pilot this month. I got a very tiny grant to develop a new idea. That's going to be called Looking for My Sister, and it's the idea of siblings and not having siblings and always having wanted to have a sister. So who knows? I mean, that could be interesting and could develop into a book idea, but it's very, very early days with that, because there's a lot that could come into that about my sort of feelings on family and how we define family and think about family. You know, I definitely think I'll keep exploring ideas around connection and relationships in the broader sense, not purely romantic sexual ones. But you know, I'm really enjoying writing journalism, like writing articles for magazines and newspapers. I've been doing a lot of that around the book publication, so I've got a few possible commissions for some of those, and I'm really enjoying that because I think it's just a fast track to the rewarding position of your article being finished and in print.
Yes, it's very quick, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas, of course, with a book, it's just all such a slow process that you...
Slightly less immediate.
Yeah, I think you can feel really lost and, you know, you can get quite down and depressed when you're writing it, particularly during a pandemic, and thinking, well, is it ever going to come out? Are bookshops going to be open? What's going to happen to the book? You know... So I think you can almost have this strange sense. I mean, we're talking about, you know, how it feels to have people read your work. There's a kind of conflict, isn't there, where part of you, you know, thinks, oh God, I don't want anyone to read my work because I am sharing such personal stuff. And there's a sort of comfort in thinking that maybe the book will just disappear. And then you're like, oh my God, why am I doing it? Don't be silly. I've got to promote it. I've got to get everybody to read it. But yeah, there is a sort of self-protection that kind of kicks in, I think, just before it, where I kind of suddenly felt a bit exposed and I didn't want people to read it. It's a really weird kind of conflict.
Yeah.
What you want to do, if you want to stop people reading it, if you get up early on the day it's published and go to the bookshop and post a handwritten note through the door and see if you can get them to take it off the shelf. That's what you want to do.
Good callback.
That's what you want to do.
You seem to pack a lot in, Rosie. You're a bit of a polymath, aren't you, I think? You seem to have done a bit of everything. Do you get bored quite easily?
Switched off for a minute there.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying,
making a joke.
It sounds like you're a bit of a polymath. Do you get bored really easily? You've done so much
stuff. I was making a joke at your expense. Don't worry.
Sorry.
Because your question was boring and long. So she got bored.
God,
and now, now everyone else is. Everyone listening is now. Brilliant. Well done, John.
No, do I get bored? I mean, I like having different strings to my bow, different things to be working on. You know, I think it's been good to focus on one theme, but explore it through different mediums. So, you know, with the podcast and the book and magazine articles now as well, and really get deep into breakups. I mean, breakups has been, you know, my creative work now for several years.
I mean,
there are other people who've written about breakups, you know, and written great books and articles, and there are other podcasts about breakups. But I would be surprised if anyone else has done the amount of nerdy research and thinking that I've done about breakups. And I've kind of put myself into science experiments, you know, as a real life kind of guinea pig. So where I've had my genital arousal measured.
Yeah, I was listening to that bit of your book, in fact, a couple of nights ago. That was astonishing.
Oh, wow. So, you know, I've really tried to go deep into this topic.
Literally deep. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, this topic has gone deep into me. I don't know.
Yeah. Getting a little bit...
Bit old.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you ever get that feeling it's time to end an interview? There we go. Then that was. I don't know if anyone heard that. Did you hear that bit?
Indeed.
That was the end. That little bit of silence was literally the end of the interview. So it's ended now. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Oh,
Rose.
Brilliant!
Really
lovely so much for joining
thank
us.
Thank you. I hope people will keep in touch and check out the book. I love to hear what people think of it. It's I'm at Breakup Monologues on Instagram and at Rosie Wilby on Twitter. So keep in touch.
Well, thanks, Rosie. Have a lovely day.
Right, take care.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
Well, wasn't that nice?
Yeah, good stuff.
That was good nice. Really, what a lovely lady. And as we said before, you should go immediately and buy the Breakup Monologues or listen to the Breakup Monologues podcast wherever... Well, right here. Wherever you're listening to this podcast, you can probably listen to that podcast as well.
I feel a bit sorry for Rosie, actually.
Why?
Just because I thought that was a pretty good interview, wasn't it?
That was amazing. But, of course it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then... We've got a big announcement coming up, and it's just going to...
Oh, overshadow.
The whole interview is just going to pale into insignificance,
right.
Really,
just
isn't it?
Just about it. Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's such a big... There goes the klaxon again. It's just such a huge announcement.
It really is. It's massive.
Yeah, so announce it then, Tom. What is it that we've got to announce to the world exclusively here now?
We're just going to do like a little writing competition and stuff, so it's cool.
And that's it for this week, guys. Catch us next Monday. And we're launching a flash fiction competition.
Yeah.
What else? It's Halloween themed.
Halloween themed, yeah.
What is the most important thing? There's £100 up for grabs.
100 cash sterling.
Four ponies.
50.
Yeah.
Quid.
As they call it on the street, Dave. What? Yeah.
Exactly.
Have you got 50 quid for me, Andy, mate?
A fifth of a monkey, I think they call it.
Has 100 got a name? What's a monkey? A monkey's 250, isn't
monkey's
it?
Monkey's 500, isn't it?
A ton. It's a ton, isn't it?
Yes,
it's a ton.
A ton.
Oh, of course it is. Yeah. Of course it is. I was hoping it'd be something like a badger or something. But no, it's just a ton, isn't it?
We can call it a badger.
It's a ton.
Yeah.
So your prize.
Win a badger.
Yeah. So 100 smackaroos just for doing something you love doing anyway.
And get to hear your entry, if it wins, read aloud by professional voice actors live on this show.
Hey, do you know what else we could do? We could even throw in some Failing Writers merch.
Yes!
We got Money Can't Buy Failing Writers t-shirt. What else we got? Bookmarks. We chuck in a few bookmarks. I mean, let's just go for it. We're really going for it with this competition.
So yeah, flash fiction competition, Halloween thing. It doesn't have to be about ghosts or... It just needs to have something about Halloween in it. It can be anything, can't it? Use your imagination.
Yeah.
Be creative.
So you can find all the details at failingwriterspodcast.com/blog. But the most important detail is that in order to enter the competition, you have to listen to next week's show. Episode 24 will contain all of the very specific details of the competition.
The things you will need to include in the story.
And the winner will be revealed on Halloween itself.
Ooh. Do you have a Halloween themed klaxon noise that you do, Dave, for this time? Or not?
I don't know. How do you do it? Ooh.
Well, that's I think you got it.
Sort of, isn't it? So until then, let's just say au revoir.
Au revoir.
I feel that we're very much sort of diversity champions on this podcast because there are literally people from all walks of life who have never listened to the show. And I think it's a great sort of coming
together.
We're
equally ignored by all sexualities, races, genders, everything.
Exactly,
Yeah, very much so. Yep. Very, very much so.
That's what we're all aiming for, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?